Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Amnesty International releases its annual report looking behind the scenes at human rights abuses in countries across the globe and spreading the gospel to the ends of the earth, why the pastoral care of migrants and people on the move has become a top priority for the church today. No one should be above the law, yet power politics is worsening a global justice gap, condemning millions of people to abuse, poverty and oppression. That's the message from the human rights group Amnesty International, whose annual report was released on Thursday. According to this State of the World's Human Rights Report, which documents abuses in 159 nations, powerful governments are guilty of blocking advances in international justice by standing above the law and putting political self-interest above the rights of their citizens.
What we mean is that today too many perpetrators of some of the worst crimes are getting away with it, literally with murder in some cases, and also that people who are seeking to access justice for the implementation of rights such as their right to health, education, are also finding all kinds of obstacles, and governments are failing them in that regard.
Claudio Cordone is Amnesty's interim secretary general. He told me more about the main focus of the organization's work over this past year.
So we're calling on governments to ensure that systems of international justice, such as the International Criminal Court, are supported and can operate. And also we're calling on governments that will be reviewing the Millennium Development Goals shortly in September to make sure that these are not just political promises, but they're actually enforceable, turned into enforceable rights.
Looking at that first point, the whole question of impunity, are there particular areas in which you're most concerned about this problem?
Our main concern is the double standards and the fact that some governments hold themselves above the law, for example, by not signing up to the International Criminal Court, or that they protect their allies in forums such as the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. One example of this last year was the way Sri Lanka got away without taking any measure of accountability for the final stages of the conflict between the government and the Tamil Tigers, that resulted in war crimes and other abuses by both sides. Despite repeated promises, the government has taken no serious measures of accountability. And this is why we're calling today, we're repeating our calls for the United Nations to set up an independent commission of inquiry into those abuses. This was just one example as to how power politics trumped justice last year.
It is an example that is often repeated in conflict zones, though. I mean, what else can you really do to try and ensure that those who are committing war crimes and total disregard for civilians, that they are brought to justice?
One thing that government can do is for all of them to sign up to the International Criminal Court. 111 countries are today state parties to the court. At the same time, government can enact legislation and equip themselves with ways to make sure that people who are responsible or accused of crimes under international law can be brought to court before their own national courts. Today, some 40 countries have done so, and we would like more of that. So that would then reinforce a system of international justice that would leave little room for people to get away, whether they have immunity at home, for example, but to get away with some of the worst crimes.
The International Criminal Court, it had a fairly difficult beginning, didn't it? And there are some countries who seem to remain firmly opposed to the idea. What can you do about that?
Well, partly by showing that the court is serious, that there is no risk of politicized prosecutions and so on. And I think the court has carefully chosen, or has been asked by some states to actually look into their situation. And in that respect, so for example, even the arrest warrant against President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan, which we see as a landmark last year, is an important step forward. It's been taken after careful consideration. And we've been disappointed by the reaction of the African Union that basically decided not to cooperate with the court, although it is important to underline the fact that states like South Africa and Botswana had actually dissociated themselves from that position.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the international review meeting on the ICC will be taking place in Africa, in Kampala, at the end of this month. What hopes do you have for that meeting?
Well, we look forward to that meeting first to strengthen the cooperation among states. And at the same time, we think the meeting is a good opportunity for the countries that have not yet signed up to the International Criminal Court to do so. To show that beyond the rhetoric of justice and so on, they actually do mean it when it comes to the hard facts of holding people to account for the brutality of crimes that are being committed in conflicts and outside conflicts in so many parts of the world.
Looking at some of the other areas that you're highlighting in this report, you're extremely concerned about increased reports of domestic violence against women, rape and sexual abuse of all kinds. This despite the fact that gender equality is one of the Millennium Development Goals. How can this be? I mean, it seems like a total failure of this particular goal.
Precisely, and that's why we want to see much more concrete engagement with the Millennium Development Goals. And one way to actually be able to achieve most of these goals is, in fact, to improve the status of women around the world. Much of the problems related to poverty, to maternal mortality, to education are due to the fact that women continue to be discriminated by states, by law, in the homes, that you have things such as enforced marriages, female genital mutilation, all kinds of other ways in which women are held back. And women are also not allowed really to participate in political processes, in the resolution of conflicts where their role will be determinant. So there is all these areas in which we would expect states to engage with if they are serious to redress the gender imbalance and to make sure that some of the scandals, such as violence against women, such as the other forms of repression of women's rights, are actually effectively dealt with.
Closer to home, you're talking about your serious concerns over a rise in racism, xenophobia and intolerance in Europe and places like Central Asia as well.
That's correct. And we're seeing, for example, in the attitudes towards minorities such as the Roma. We have forced evictions, discrimination in school systems from in Italy to the Czech Republic to Hungary. We've seen still episodes of intolerance with regard to the gay community. And I think there is indeed a rise in Islamophobia, and in some respects this may also be behind the attempts to introduce bans on face veils, such as the one that's just been passed in Belgium and that is being discussed in France, which we think are measures that actually do not protect women's rights. They actually violate their freedom of expression, and it is another symptom of intolerance that unfortunately has been increasing in Europe and in Central Asia.
Given that these issues are of great concern to faith communities in many of the countries that you're looking at, what role do you see faith communities playing in this struggle for greater justice, greater rights, particularly for women?
I think faith communities, as well as people of faith together with other people where we share common values, particularly with regard to things such as poverty, the issue of discrimination and so on, can join forces. Let's not forget that all we're talking about is the implementation of the values of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that can and is supported by people of very different faiths and people of no faith at all. And our appeal is, again, for people to play their role, whatever they are, in their society, in government or elsewhere, to make sure that those ideals are turned into reality.
You note that the Millennium Development Goals review meeting is taking place in New York this September, and you're calling on world leaders to move from promises to legally enforceable commitments. How exactly do you do that?
Well, there are a number of ways in which states can turn these goals into an effective tool. One is to ensure the participation of people who are affected by these decisions in the decisions themselves. Far too many people are being excluded from the processes that lead to decisions on education, health, and so on. Another way is to make sure that there are proper mechanisms to hold governments to account for the policies that they adopt, whether these policies work or don't work. And ultimately, it's also important to make sure that people have access to justice systems. For example, if they are being wrongly evicted from their homes, they should be able to go to a judge and demand that they're being given compensation and another shelter. If people have to pay bribes in order to get proper health care, they should be able to use effectively the justice system to clamp down on these abuses. So there's a range of things, very concrete things that government should be doing in order to turn these Millennium Development Goals into actual realities and not just promises.
Thanks there to Claudio Cordone, Interim Secretary General for the London-based Amnesty International. Migration is one of the key ways in which the gospel of Christ continues to spread and to permeate the furthest corners of our world today. Churches themselves are often the first point of contact for people moving to a new country or working far away from home. Those are just two of the reasons why the care of migrants and all people on the move has become an increasingly high priority for the church worldwide. The key challenge is how to help people adapt to their new cultural context without losing the many positive and faith-filled values they bring from their own native cultures and communities.
There's quite a beautiful quality in the Hispanic peoples, and not just them. I'd say the Filipino people are that way in several of the Catholic cultures that are coming to the United States. The Vietnamese culture, for instance, they tend to be much more community-based.
Jesuit Father Alan Deck heads the U.S. Bishop's Secretariat for Cultural Diversity in the Church. He told me about the work of this important organization and the challenges facing Catholics of different cultures in the American Church today.
Well, it came into existence a little less than 3 years ago, and its basic mandate is to be the pastoral presence of the American bishops with all the various cultural groups, most of them of non-European origin, that today make up the majority of the American Catholics. The biggest group is the Hispanic people from Latin America, but there are several others as well: African Americans, Native Americans, Asian and Pacific Island peoples, and a tremendous variety of people that have come recently to the United States, some of them refugees from Asia. But about 40% of all the refugees that come to the United States are Roman Catholic, and they are often settled through the auspices of the Catholic Church. So we have an ongoing relationship to newcomers.
You're talking about the work with these mainly non-European members of the church. We think of America as the place where the great melting pot, where integration takes place quite easily compared, for example, with some of our European countries. How true is that in your case?
Well, I think it's true, but I believe that at this point in history, the church is realizing that it was not as successful in finding the right balance in helping integrate or assimilate various immigrant groups into the United States experience. By that I mean that we realize now that we have tended to be very concerned with assimilating or acculturating newcomers. But in the process, we have not also taken care to clearly proclaim the Christian values that could be used by these newcomers to discern how they're going to participate in their new homeland. So we're more aware of the need to stress the importance of respecting each culture, as well as bringing Catholic identity and Catholic values into consideration as early as possible, so that the adaptation of the people will strengthen their faith and not weaken it.
Many of these people, as you say, are coming from strong Catholic backgrounds, perhaps with a stronger faith than they're finding in their new host country.
Yes, this is very true of the Latin American immigrants. several of the groups from Asia, certainly the Filipino people, the Korean Catholic people, the Vietnamese Catholic people, they're all very rooted. And in the case of the Hispanics, it's a form of Catholicism that permeated their, historically, their cultures. Sometimes this is referred to as cultural Catholicism. I think that the church respects what was accomplished during many centuries in Latin America. However, I do believe that the church, and I know that our bishops in the United States, realize that that kind of cultural Catholicism is not adequate. It's a good place to start, but the challenge is to help people assume more personal responsibility for their faith, certainly more knowledge. There needs to be a more adequate catechesis of the adults, not just of the children, but of the adults, if they're going to be able to stand up on their feet and participate as committed Catholics in American culture, which becomes, like the culture here in Europe, more and more secular.
Aside from the spiritual work that you're doing, I imagine you're also involved in very practical support and assistance for the new arrivals particularly, aren't you?
Yes, we're involved in encouraging them to organize themselves in some way. We have a system of what we call national advisors for the new groups in particular. The Hispanics don't really need that so much because really, the Latin American Catholic people have been in the United States actually before the English-speaking people came there, but it's a long and drawn-out story. There are many structures and institutions now that serve the Hispanic people, so they're in one situation. The African American Catholic is in another situation. We have 3 million African American Catholics, and as I say, each group is a different situation. But we try to work with all of them. We try to encourage them to participate. We're very concerned about the need for vocations to the priesthood, the religious life, men and women among these groups. And the groups themselves, of course, are very concerned about their children. What's going to happen to their children in terms of their practice of the faith?
Do you find that the second generation tends to be much more distanced from the faith?
Undoubtedly, that one of the trends that we see is that with education and with socioeconomic mobility, in the case of several of these immigrant groups, there does seem to begin a distancing, a process of distancing themselves more from the church. And recent studies, surveys, sociological studies, seem to bear that out.
Are you also involved in advocacy work for those in particularly difficult situations?
We work very closely with Migrant Refugee Services, which is another very big, matter of fact, the biggest department of the Bishops' Conference in Washington, and also with the Committee on Domestic Justice and Peace. Those two groups, Migrant Refugee Services and Justice and Peace, have a program, for instance, called Justice for Immigrants. And right now, we are very involved in trying to promote a reform of the immigration laws in the United States. This is something that the Catholic bishops have been engaged in actually for decades in the United States at different moments when the country needed to address the reality of migration and plan for it and what have you. Right now, we have a very difficult situation with at least 11 million irregular or undocumented immigrants that have been in the country for sometimes for two or three decades, who have children who really don't know any other country except the United States, but have been unable to regularize their situation. This is a very terrible situation, and the bishops have been very forthright in advocating on behalf of the immigrants.
The immigrants themselves have become increasingly vocal, haven't they? We've seen walkout strikes just to make people realize how essential they are to the running of the economy in many different ways.
Yes, they have. In the case of the Latin American immigrants, we've seen a move toward, for those that are able to, a move toward becoming U.S. citizens and becoming citizens and then voting. And in the past 10 years, the Hispanic vote in the United States has become a critical vote. That is, the Latino vote is capable of determining who becomes president, for instance. This is the first time that the Latin American community has been engaged that much in the process. And this is a very good thing in a democracy.
And yet down in the southern states, there seems to be a hardening of attitude towards letting migrants come and work in the United States. I'm thinking specifically of the new law, the very controversial law in Arizona.
Yes. It's not just in the South, by the way. In several parts of the United States, there's anti-immigrant sentiment. When one studies this in history, one discovers that really throughout the history of the United States, there's been a cycle of being open to immigrants, opening the doors, recognizing that really everybody is an immigrant or everybody's ancestors were immigrants. The Native American people perhaps could say that they're not, but everybody else really has a history as an immigrant. But we alternate between being receptive and then being very anti-immigrant.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, it's part of the political and the economic process. For one thing, for any country, it's always easy to blame immigrants for unemployment or some other national problem. In other words, they become easy scapegoats. And so we have had this very ugly and unpleasant history of going back and forth on the issue of immigration. And yet everybody knows, I mean, those who study the reality know that the global economy really is one of the main sources or causes for the movement of people, you know, that our economy really requires this kind of thing. And yet people have a hard time dealing with it. And of course, there's the reality of nationalism, exaggerated nationalism.
The church, as you say, has often been the most vocal opponent of these extreme sentiments of nationalism and a rejection of people from other countries, hasn't it?
Yes, the church has. And I believe that today, when the church bases its role in the world or understands itself as having the mission to evangelize, which is to proclaim the gospel to each and every culture, the church realizes today what is at stake in the movement of people around the world, especially people that are Catholic, how migration really has become one of the main ways in which the Catholic faith is propagating itself. For example, in the United States, the Catholic Church would not grow at all. As a matter of fact, it would be shrinking if it were not for the coming of immigrants. So that migration is a blessing from several points of view, but for the church, it's a way in which the gospel message is being planted in the lives of different nations throughout the world. This is a very interesting development.
And shaping and changing, therefore, the expression of Catholic faith in America.
Yes, it is. I would say that, for instance, the coming of the Latin American people after the Second World War in very large numbers into the United States has had quite an impact on American Catholicism. One of the main things that it has helped do is provide a somewhat more festive, more celebration, a more spontaneous approach to prayer and worship, and perhaps more affective approach to the faith than what we were used to in the Catholicism, you might say standard American Catholicism. And religious educators tell us that one of the most important or successful environments for promoting the faith is an environment of joy and celebration. And the Hispanic people, I think, are bringing that wherever they go in the church.
These are the very positive, very visible aspects of change. What do you see as your hardest challenges, the most difficult problems you face in terms of integrating these people into the church?
Well, I think that the key question is linking people's identity with Catholic identity. In other words, the church is not simply trying to promote cultures for the sake of promoting cultures. The church is promoting culture because culture is the target, is the object of the church's evangelizing effort. And so we must respect culture, but we also need to help people become discerning about their cultures. In other words, it's not a question of preserving all our cultural values, because take any culture, they all have disvalues and values. It's not just a totally good thing. It's a mixed bag. And the gospel then becomes a criteria, a norm for peoples to judge the real Christian value of their culture. And that is always a challenge, because people do not want to be moved beyond their comfort zones. But when we preach, when we teach, that's exactly what we have to do.
So can you give me some specific examples of the way this works with, for example, the Hispanic community or the African community? Yeah.
Well, I would say that in the case of the Hispanic community, there is something very Christian that's deeply embedded in their culture that has to do with their tendency to put family and community before individual interests. I think that in the Western world, particularly in developed countries of Europe and North America and so forth, that even the Catholics have become what some people would say is individualistic. They tend to be individualistic. Each person is kind of like a free-floating atom pursuing his or her own interests. Well, this really is not a Christian way of conceiving of life. And yet it seems to be so much part of, you know, the modern secular attitude where everybody is aspiring to become wealthier or better or something. Well, the Hispanic peoples tend, although of course there are always exceptions to this, but they do tend to be much more focused on the community. And they make the sacrifice necessary in order to be faithful to their community, because really there's no secret that, you know, community is a nice thing. Everybody claims they're in favor of it. But when it comes down to making hard choices that mean that I have to give up something so that the group can benefit, well, then it becomes difficult. Huh? So there's quite a beautiful quality in the Hispanic peoples, and not just them. I'd say the Filipino people are that way, and several of the Catholic cultures that are coming to the United States, the Vietnamese culture, for instance, they tend to be much more community-based. I believe that that's probably an opportunity for the Catholic Church in the United States to evangelize American culture if we can work with these cultures and help them maintain that community orientation in a very individualistic society.
My thanks there to Jesuit Father Alan Deck, Executive Director of the U.S. Bishop's Secretariat for Cultural Diversity in the Church. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.